Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Francine Foss and Anish Chagpar. Dr. Foss is a professor of medical oncology and dermatology specializing in the treatment of lymphomas. Dr. Chagpar is associate professor of surgical oncology and director of the Breast Center at Smilow Cancer Hospital at Yale New Haven. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This week, Drs. Foss and Chagpar welcome Dr. Aileen Garapi. Dr. Garapi is Assistant Professor of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Sciences and Assistant Clinical Professor of Nursing at the Yale School of Nursing. Here's Francine Foss.
Now, can you start out by telling us a little bit about yourself? I understand that you recently came here to the Smilow Cancer Center. Can you explain to us why you were recruited to our cancer center?
Yes, I'd love to. I was recruited to Yale about a year and a half ago after finishing a family planning fellowship at the University of Pittsburgh at McGee Women's Hospital. And I was recruited to the Department of OB-GYN to help start a family planning section. As we learn more in medicine, there are more subspecialties in obstetrics and gynecology. And family planning is the subspecialty that helps to prevent pregnancy and women who don't want to be pregnant, and helps take care of women who have pregnancies that have gone horribly awry.
So tell us a little bit more about how that intersects with the cancer center and with people who have a cancer diagnosis.
Great. I'd love to. I think that for women who are cancer survivors or who are currently going through cancer treatment, the outcome of having an unintended pregnancy can be really devastating. For one, it can impact diagnosis and treatment if there is a delay in order to get beneficial chemotherapy while balancing the concerns of teratogenicity or fetal anomalies that chemotherapy or radiation therapy can affect a developing fetus. It could also be emotionally devastating for patients who have to make choices between their own treatment and their own well-being versus that of a fetus's. And pregnancy in and of itself has a lot of risks that can complicate cancer. Just for example, our greatest risk of developing a clot as females is during pregnancy.
Can you tell us about the spectrum of women that you see? Do you see women at all ages? Are there certain ages? And this is a question some of us, you know, always ask ourselves. Is there an age at which you really can't get pregnant? So is there a cutoff?
I see women of all age groups. Often some of the best conversations to have are with young girls who are not yet sexually active, to be able to talk about their bodies and valuing their bodies and making good choices, up to women in their early 50s. The mean age of menopause when we can't get pregnant anymore in the United States is 52. And as far as cancer patients, I've had a fair number of consultations so far for women that are BRCA1 and BRCA2 positive, so have a genetic predisposition to developing breast or ovarian cancer, and talking about timing their pregnancies and timing their prophylactic surgeries, and talking about what kinds of contraception are safe for them and can be utilized.
So let's pick up there, because I think that that is really an issue that a lot of our listeners may be thinking about in terms of genetic risk, and particularly for those who have a BRCA1 or 2 gene mutation. So these are women who are at risk of developing breast or ovarian cancer, how you counsel them. Because for a lot of them, they're wondering about, can I have a family? Should I have a family? When do I time this? So walk us through the conversations that you might have with a person who has a BRCA mutation.
I think that's a great question. And probably the biggest point is that it's a multidisciplinary discussion as well. In connection with the genetic counselors and with the gynecologic oncologists, who are the subspecialists in obstetrics and gynecology that take care of the cancer portion of that, and talking with reproductive endocrinology and infertility, which are the subspecialists that can help women get pregnant, and the maternal fetal medicine doctors, who are the high-risk obstetricians that can take care of women during pregnancy. And so having that conversation all together, it focuses on where the woman is in her childbearing and in her partnership, because if someone is young woman is 18 years old and finally decided to get tested and comes back positive for BRCA1, statistically speaking, most likely she's not going to be in a relationship and ready to have a family, but she's going to want to look at things that can decrease her risk. And we know that, for example, combined oral contraceptive pills decrease the risk of ovarian cancer. The downside of using birth control pills is that they're not as effective as at preventing pregnancy as kind of the top tier methods of contraception, which are the two different kinds of IUDs and the implant that goes in the arm. So it's very much a tailored discussion, an individual discussion, kind of weighing the risks and benefits of the contraception itself, where she is in terms of just having a diagnosis of an increased risk or having had a history of cancer for people that are childhood cancer survivors, and then what her future planning looks like. And I think that that's the benefit of having a family planning specialist at Yale and at a lot of other major medical centers, is that we are the ones that can look at that literature to really come up with an individualized plan for each person based on what it is that they want, where they are at their life.
So many of your patients fall into that category, or are many of them women who just got a cancer diagnosis, for instance?
I think it's probably about half and half right now. Probably more with the predisposition to cancer coming, more younger women coming to see us.
Can you talk a little bit about the options? You mentioned some of them with oral contraceptives and the implants and some of the other methods. Can you talk about specifically each one of those and how you integrate that with the therapy that the woman is going to receive?
Yes. I think one of the most important things to share with patients and women that are listening and healthcare providers is the fact that not all contraception is created equally. And so there is differences in the effectiveness of contraception. In general, we can split contraception into three groups based on how well it works. The bottom level group has about a 20% risk of failing, so a 20% chance of pregnancy over the course of a year. That's male and female condoms, the diaphragm, natural family planning when we try to abstain from intercourse around the time that we think we might be fertile, and withdrawal or pulling out when the man pulls out before ejaculating. Those all have a 20% chance of failure. The middle of the road is the birth control pill, the birth control patch, the birth control ring, and Depo Provera. And they, in general, have a 10% failure rate, so a 10% chance of getting pregnant. And then the top of the line are the two IUDs. There's a copper IUD and a progestin-only IUD, and then also an implant that goes in the arm. And the three of those are just as effective as getting your tubes tied, but 100% reversible. And they only last as long as they're in, and they have less than a 1% failure rate. So, and that's just kind of the viewpoint of efficacy of contraception. And then I think that then needs to overlay with what her cancer diagnosis is, where she is in treatment, and having a conversation with the oncologist or the other surgeons about what her treatment plan is to come up with something that's going to meet her needs.
So does different treatment plans, so different women who have different cancers, presumably when you're undergoing therapy, especially if it's chemotherapy, you may want to abstain or avoid getting pregnant while you're on therapy. How does the type of diagnosis influence that, or whether patients may be having other kinds of treatment like radiation influence your choices? And how do patients find their way to a family planning specialist, or is that something that they often try to do on their own? How does that whole process work?
I think patients often try to do a lot on their own. And certainly being able to talk to your audience today, I think, is helpful, because I want to let patients and providers know that we are here to help with those conversations. I think that we don't have a great idea of the burden of unintended pregnancy in cancer survivors. It's not something that we've talked a lot about. I think because cancer is so big and overwhelming, and rightfully so, is the priority of a lot of the discussion, that in surveys and some data that we have, we know that female cancer survivors and patients undergoing cancer therapy have said that they felt like their reproductive health needs were not met. And that mostly has to do with concerns of preventing pregnancy. So I do think that there's some work for us to do there. And we know that patients that currently have cancer are more likely to terminate a pregnancy if they do become pregnant during their treatment. Then to get to the other question about matching up what kind of contraception is going to work best, I think the most effective contraception is always first line. So the Paragard IUD, which is the copper IUD, has no hormones in it, and so can be kind of universally recommended for anyone with cancer, with breast cancer, with ovarian cancer, with lung cancer, with, I mean, the list can go on. One of the helpful tools that exist is something called the Center for Disease Control's medical eligibility criteria for contraception, which was really an effort on the part of my community and family planning to kind of do many meta-analyses and many reviews looking at the different types of not just cancers, but also chronic medical conditions like hypertension and diabetes, and which of the forms of birth control, hormonal or not, and then within hormonal, which hormones and which are safe for people with contraception. Just getting back to the idea that not all contraception is created equally, some women can have estrogen and progestin. It's not going to affect their cancer. It might even be beneficial to their cancer or their risk of cancer, as we talked about combined hormonal birth controls and BRCA1 individuals. And for other women with a history of hormone receptor positive breast cancer, then combined hormonal contraception probably is not going to be the best option for them. And again, to say that's really where I think I can be helpful to our patients is to be able to take a detailed history, to be able to communicate and coordinate with other providers in order to come up with a tailored plan. Because it's all these competing interests that need to be balanced to help get her the outcome which she wants, which is to be cancer-free and not pregnant until she wants to be.
Can you comment on the use of the IUDs in particular in some of our patients with leukemia and hematologic malignancies where their blood counts are going to be low, their platelet counts are going to be low, there may be some risks of bleeding?
Mm-hmm.
How do you factor that into your decision, and is that a real risk with these IUDs?
I think that's a great question. IUDs are a wonderful form of contraception. The IUD that's been on the market longer, the copper IUD, some women who use it can have bleeding that's heavier, longer, and crampier. So I wouldn't recommend that for someone with anemia or at risk of bleeding. But the other IUD, the newer IUD, which is a progestin-only IUD, makes our periods lighter, shorter, and with less cramping, and is actually FDA approved and recommended for women who have heavy periods. So that would kind of be a very good option for people who are having anemia related to their cancer or related to the cancer treatment.
Do you believe that we should be suppressing the periods completely? I mean, there's some philosophy out there that you should suppress ovulation during chemotherapy. Is that necessary? Are there any benefits to that?
That's a great question. Just thinking back to the risk of ovarian cancer, you know, we used to think it was the number of ovulations that increase the risk of ovarian cancer in women who are BRCA1 positive. But now we think it actually has more to do with the fallopian tube, and that it's not actually the release of the egg and the repair of the trauma that comes from ovulation. So I'm not sure that we have the answers to that question yet.
Well, you know what? With that, we're going to take a very short break for a medical minute. But when we come back, hopefully we'll talk a little bit more about family planning and how that plays in both for cancer patients as well as cancer survivors. So please stay tuned for our continued discussion of family planning and contraception during cancer diagnosis with Dr. Eileen Garapi.
Breast cancer is the most common cancer in women. In Connecticut alone, approximately 3,000 women will be diagnosed with breast cancer this year. But there is new hope. Earlier detection, non-invasive treatments, and novel therapies provide more options for patients to fight breast cancer. Women should schedule a baseline mammogram beginning at age 40 or earlier if they have risk factors associated with the disease. With screening, early detection, and a healthy lifestyle, breast cancer can be defeated. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, such as Yale Cancer Center, to make innovative new treatments available to patients. A potential breakthrough in treating chemotherapy-resistant breast cancer is now being studied at Yale, combining BSI-101, a PARP inhibitor, with the chemotherapy drug irinotecan. This has been a Medical Minute, brought to you as a public service by the Yale Cancer Center. More information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to WNPR, Connecticut's public radio station.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Anish Chagpar, and I'm joined today by my co-host, Dr. Francine Foss. Today, we're talking to Dr. Aileen Garapi and talking to her about contraception and family planning, both prior to a cancer diagnosis, during a cancer diagnosis, and afterwards. So, Aileen, one of the things that you had talked a little bit about before the break was a variety of mechanisms that women can avail themselves of that will prevent them from getting pregnant. Can you talk a little bit about what are the common misconceptions that you see in practice that you think people may not be aware of and how you go about counseling patients about that?
Thank you, Anise. I think that's a great question and a very interesting and important topic as part of this conversation. One of the most unfortunate and common circumstances I see for women with a history of cancer, a current diagnosis of cancer, is either a primary care physician or maybe even an oncologist worried about the risk of cancer, of cancer recurrence, or of a side effect of cancer like having a deep vein thrombosis coming from using certain kinds of contraception. The result of that is that they advise the patient to stop contraception, but maybe don't give her a good avenue to pursue better options. And then the patient is referred to me when she has an unintended pregnancy. And I think that is an area where we're not serving women as well as we can. Most contraception is safe, even for women with cancer or with a history of cancer. And I think the important thing to consider is always kind of the idea of compared to what, because the risk of getting a clot in general for women on birth control pills, on combined hormonal birth control pills, is about 1 in 10,000. And the risk of getting a clot during pregnancy is about 25 times higher. So if you're trying to avoid someone getting a clot, they are much better off being on a form of birth control than they are getting pregnant.
And as you had mentioned before the break, there are a variety of forms of birth control that don't involve combined hormones, right?
Right. So the copper IUD doesn't have any hormones in it. And then the progestin-only forms of contraception, all the best evidence says that they are absolutely safe to take in people who have a history of clots even, and that there's not a significantly increased risk of forming clots on progestin-only contraception. So that would be the levonorgestrel progestin-only IUD, which just delivers progestin locally. And as we talked about early, can make periods lighter, shorter, and with less cramping, and has less than a 1% failure rate. And then the etanogestrel, which is a type of progestin implant that goes underneath the skin in the arm and can last for up to 3 years. So that's the other important thing to say about that top tier of what we call long-acting reversible contraceptive methods, is that they are long-acting. And that's why they're more effective. The implant can last for up to 3 years. It doesn't have to stay in that long. The copper IUD can last for up to 10 years. And the progestin-only IUD can last for up to 5 years. And they don't have to stay in that long. But for someone who's already taking a lot of medication, who already has disrupted their life with a lot of radiation appointments, with chemotherapy appointments, with, you know, physical therapy, surgery, to be able to kind of set it and forget it, I think is a really big benefit of these long-acting reversible contraceptive methods, and that the reversible part is key, that they could be just as protected against pregnancy as sterilization, but then their fertility will return to what it was when the contraception is removed.
You had brought up the issue of sterilization, and I wonder how many women actually ask for that. And if they do ask for that, do you try to convince them to use one of these other methods?
A lot of women ask for sterilization. Sterilization is the most common method of birth control in the world, and it's the second most common method in the United States, second only to the birth control pill. So sterilization is definitely something that women are asking about all the time, and I think is a really important point to talk about. Thank you. there are two different kinds of female sterilization and a third kind of male sterilization. The big issue with sterilization is that it is irreversible. And so some women, I think, because we haven't done a good job of educating and increasing awareness about these long-acting reversible contraceptive methods, think that sterilization is their only option. And the downside of sterilization is, number one, is regret. So for women under the age of 30, they have a much higher chance of regret than women that are older than that. It's also surgical. Both methods for female sterilization, so there's a laparoscopic method where we make small incisions in the belly button and access the fallopian tubes, which are the carriers, the kind of conduit there to block that. And there's a hysteroscopic method where we put a camera through the cervix into the uterus to find the opening of the fallopian tubes to put coils there. But they're both surgical, and they involve the risks of surgery, whereas the IUDs and the implants are non-surgical, and they could be done there in the office. I think anytime we put more steps in front of women to get to the outcome that they want, like being sterilized, the more often we miss that outcome. So someone coming in saying that they, you know, want to have the best form of contraception possible, I could put an IUD in that day. I could put an implant in that day. I can't sterilize her that day. And it's that sending her back out to make a pre-op appointment, to come back in, to get her surgery scheduled, to then have the surgery, that all those steps increase the chance of getting pregnant when you don't want to be.
I think that's an excellent point, because for many of our chemotherapies anyway, we really need to get started fairly quickly. So there really isn't a big window of time between the cancer diagnosis and the time that they need to start definitive therapy.
Yeah. And we also were going to – one point about vasectomy, which I highly recommend, is that for men, it's a much simpler procedure than it is for the woman. And that's just, you know, by design, that the tube that we're trying to block for a man is on the outside, and for women, it's deep inside. And that any discussion about female sterilization also needs to be male sterilization also needs to be included. And that's a discussion that I have with partners, you know, and trying to come up with what the best thing is. But ultimately, if the male refuses to pursue a vasectomy, male sterilization, women, because unintended pregnancy is such a heavy weight on them, they will often, if it's sterilization that they really want, they will pursue it so that they have it under their control and not to wait for him if it's something that she doesn't think he's going to complete.
One of the things I wonder, Aileen, is if you're a young woman and you've just been faced with this incredible cancer diagnosis, which, you know, understandably would pretty much turn your world upside down, and then you're thinking about not only your future but ensuring that you don't hurt a potential fetus, how many women do you think, when you said that a lot of women come in asking for sterilization, how much of that do you think is based on fear and lack of knowledge or trust of other forms of contraception versus a true bona fide knowledge-based, evidence-based judgment on their part?
Mm-hmm. I think it's rare for the person who's never had a baby to come in asking for sterilization. Where I see it more is in women who maybe have one or two children. They thought they were going to have number three, but they were diagnosed, you know, with breast cancer. And so they've decided that, you know, they just don't want to risk it. And so and I can understand that. My point of view is that I want to give women all the information so that they can make the best choices for themselves. And there's certainly, I think, something to be understood about not wanting to go through one more thing or not wanting to have the weight of uncertainty on them. But for the most part, pregnancy can be very safe for women who are cancer survivors. And so that's something, again, a discussion to have with my colleagues in high-risk obstetrics, maternal fetal medicine, or reproductive endocrinology and fertility, to make sure that we're all on the same page and all giving her the right information so she can make the best choice for herself and her family.
It's common for people getting chemotherapy to think that they can't get pregnant. Do you run into that a lot? And also, it's probably common for them to think that they won't be able to get pregnant after.
Yes, I think we could do a better job there. There's this, I think anytime we give, most chemotherapy can affect the ovaries and the ability for the ovaries to, you know, have eggs that could still be viable and get to a pregnancy. But there's a difference between telling someone that because of their cancer diagnosis and the treatment that they're going to go under, that they're going to have a decreased likelihood of getting pregnant, that that's not the same thing as you're prevented against pregnancy. And so our bodies are magnificent, and they are very good at figuring out sometimes how to release an egg. And so if there's egg and if there's sperm, it could happen. And I think we need to do a better job of differentiating between planning for a pregnancy and what the likelihood is of you having a successful pregnancy. And even if that's low, that's not the same thing as you don't need to worry about contraception because you can't get pregnant.
So all of that is well and good. And I think that we've really convinced people that, you know, if you're looking at a cancer diagnosis and or being treated for cancer and are a woman, you really ought to be thinking about family planning. What happens if you didn't? And now all of a sudden you find yourself in the unfortunate situation of having an unwanted pregnancy. I can only imagine what that feels like for the woman and her partner and her family. What do they do? Where do they go? What are their options? How do they get advice?
Mm-hmm. I agree that could be a really devastating time. And that happens even when you've done your best to avoid pregnancy, because nothing is 100%. If that happens, they can come and see us. We take care of women who have complicated medical histories who need to end a pregnancy. And we do that with a tremendous amount of care and compassion and good sound medicine. Getting to that step is a process. I think some people, when they're faced with that reality of having, you know, an undesired pregnancy in the middle of a cancer diagnosis, they know immediately what they want to do. They want to end the pregnancy. But for others, it's a time of needing to kind of get everyone in the same room and talk about, well, what are the pluses and minuses of this? What does it mean for your diagnosis? What does it mean for the treatment that you have available? What does it mean for a developing fetus? And again, I think that's a really key interdisciplinary process that we can participate and help in.
How do you advise women who have completed their chemotherapy or their definitive treatment plan? How do you advise them as to when they can start thinking about pregnancy again? I know that's probably very variable, but, you know, what's your general approach to that discussion?
It depends on it depends on what type of cancer they've had. But for women, for example, with breast cancer, there's pretty good guidelines that they should wait for 3 years. For other types of cancers, I think it's a very individual kind of assessment.
And the good news, I guess, is that when a woman wants to get pregnant, especially if they've used a reversible type of contraception, in discussion with their oncologist and the rest of their healthcare team, that's possible. I think that for a long time, people thought, you know what, cancer equals the end of my life, the end of my family, the end of all decision-making abilities. And what I'm hearing is a far more optimistic view.
Absolutely optimistic, and getting her what she wants, getting, you know, helping her to figure out what her reproductive life plan is, and then helping her achieve it. I think that's really what my role is, and I feel very privileged to do it.
Dr. Aileen Garapi is Assistant Professor of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Sciences and Assistant Clinical Professor of Nursing at the Yale School of Nursing. If you have questions or would like to add your comments, visit yalecancercenter.org, where you can also get the podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.